If ever there was a year where we've been reminded of how fragile and how provisional our plans are, it's been 2020. 52 weeks ago, none of us could possibly have imagined what the new year would look like. The concepts and terms that would become part of everyday speech, the face masks and hand gels, all kinds of events postponed or cancelled or transferred to something called Zoom. Who could have guessed? In a context like that, there's something remarkable about what I believe is probably the best known of the verses in today's reading, and possibly the best known verse, or one of the best known verses in the whole of the book of Jeremiah, verse 11. Here it is in the NIV. "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." The ESV puts it like this: "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope." The whole verse is wonderful, but I've been particularly struck by some of its opening words. "I know the plans I have." Take yourself back 12 months and imagine someone saying that. And here's God, not in 2020, but some six centuries before the birth of Jesus, declaring that he knows the plans that he has. Imagine someone who's confident enough to announce that, but someone who's also powerful enough to see his plans fulfilled and his promises kept. "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future." It's one of those verses that we like to turn to if we want to encourage someone. Think about a friend who's lost their job, or a young person who's missed out on their first choice university. It's the kind of verse you might want to write on a card with a greeting for this time of the year, or the kind of verse that a church might choose as its motto for the start of a new year. But at the same time, it's probably one of those verses that we're tempted to use without paying proper attention to its original context. We forget that it was not written to us in the first instance, but it was written some 2,500 years ago, and it was written to a specific group of people in a specific set of circumstances. The context was exile. Exile is a significant biblical theme. Quite a number of the Bible stories involve people who are living in places where they do not fully belong. In the New Testament, Peter uses the language of exile in his first letter, written to scattered followers of Jesus. And the way he writes helps us to connect with the theme at our particular moment in history. The specific background in Jeremiah 29 is exile in Babylon. After many years of unfaithfulness, the people of Jerusalem suffer at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. There are sieges and famines. The city is eventually destroyed, including the temple, and its people are taken to Babylon, where they would remain for 70 years until the Persians had replaced the Babylonians and begun allowing people to go home. It was a time of devastation and loss. Psalm 137 gives us an insight into the deep sadness of the exiles and the raw emotion that saw them longing for the day when the cruelty of Babylon would be avenged. Jeremiah 29 records a letter written to some of the early exiles who'd been removed from Jerusalem to Babylon. Far from encouraging them to be hostile towards their captors or offering them hope that the whole thing will be short-lived, the letter tells them that they are to settle in Babylon, that they are to care for its welfare, and they are to pray for it. Eventually, they will get to go home, but it's going to be several decades. It's in the middle of all that the Lord speaks about his plans. "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." Settle in Babylon. The first part of the message in the letter was that the exiles should settle in Babylon, for it was God who'd brought them there. Now, you notice a contrast between verse 1 and verse 4 and what they say about who had removed the people into exile. In verse 1, it's Nebuchadnezzar who removed them. In verse 4, it's the Lord who sent them. In other words, God had brought them here using Nebuchadnezzar as his agent. If that seems puzzling to you, you're in good company. About 40 or 50 years or so before Jerusalem fell, there was a prophet called Habakkuk. He was a troubled soul, first because of the evil he saw in society and the fact that God seemed to stand by. But then, when God does something about the evil that Habakkuk saw, he says that he will use what you would describe as unconventional means. He will use the Babylonians. Yet as Habakkuk works through what it means to trust God in all this, he writes this: though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. That's a tremendous statement of faith. Now, all of this means that in the process of exile, Nebuchadnezzar is at work as a powerful ruler, but God is also at work as the sovereign Lord, just as he was at work in the life of Joseph in Genesis when his brothers sold him into slavery, but it was God who'd sent him to save lives, and just as he was in the crucifixion of Jesus, who was executed by the Romans, yet presented by God as a sacrifice to deal with sin. This is the mystery of the sovereignty of God. And for the exiles, it meant that God's hand was in their exile. That's the first thing that the letter told them. And it went on to tell them that they would be in Babylon for a long time, 70 years, and that they were to take actions that were relatively long-term actions, building houses, planting gardens, having children, and seeing their children married. Now, there were voices that claimed to speak for God, but that had a different message. There were people who said that Jerusalem would not fall to Babylon. Then in chapter 28, there was a prophet called Hananiah who forecast that the yoke of Babylon would be broken and that the people would return to Jerusalem within a couple of years. That would have been a very popular message. You can imagine the kind of relief that this ordeal is not really going to last too long. I think we can identify with this to some degree from our experience of 2020. Think about some of the people who were predicting that we would be well clear of the pandemic by now. We would have hoped that their promises were solid, but here we are, and we're still waiting. And for Jeremiah's exiles, there would be no quick fix. And that's what Jeremiah told them. He had an unpopular message. And so they must settle in Babylon and must make plans to be there for a while. But God had by no means finished with them, for his plan was not to harm them. It was for their blessing, to give them hope and a future. The second thing that they were to do was that they were to care for Babylon. They were to seek the peace and prosperity of the city. That's a further step. It's one thing to settle there, but it's another to wish well on your neighbours and on the society around you, especially when those neighbours are your enemies. How do you seek the welfare of people you don't like? You might think about the story of Jonah and how Jonah went on the run from God rather than go to preach to the Assyrians of the city of Nineveh. Jonah was an Israelite. The Assyrians were a thorn in the flesh of his people, would eventually be more than that. And it's one thing to go and preach judgment to them, but it's another to do so in the knowledge that God is merciful and that God is likely to forgive the Ninevites if they respond to Jonah's message. And now here are the exiles from Jerusalem, and they're being asked to seek the peace and prosperity or the welfare of Babylon. The Hebrew word for welfare is one that you'll recognize. Shalom. Now, this is where it's interesting, I think, to put Psalm 137 and Jeremiah 29 together. These people are being asked to seek the peace and well-being of a city that had destroyed their city. Some of those people had mocked them by asking them to sing one of the songs of Zion. And for many of them, the desire that came naturally to them would surely have been a desire not for shalom, but it would have been a desire for judgment and vengeance. And the call to seek the shalom of Babylon was a call to love a nation that had not been kind to their city. Now, it's striking that there were key people among the exiles, like Daniel and his friends, who rose through the ranks in exile. Daniel's a striking example of someone who never forgot Jerusalem, but who sought the welfare of his captors, specifically Nebuchadnezzar. Or another illustration, although it's a different story from a different time, there's the story of the young Israeli girl who was captured by the Syrians and found herself working for Naaman, a military commander who had leprosy. And we see that whatever loss she had experienced in being captured did not prevent her from directing her master to Elisha, where he found healing. I think you get a glimpse of what it means to do good and behave well towards your captors when you're living in exile. Now, years ago, you would have heard people talk a lot about worldliness. I'm not sure that people talk quite so much about it nowadays. I remember reading a story about a man who sent back a television that he had bought because it said on the box that the television brings the world right into your home. Now, there's no doubt that there are many things about our surrounding culture that we would prefer not to bring into our homes. And some of us would like to be as detached as we possibly can be from the world. But at the same time, it's possible to be so detached that we end up bringing very little benefit to the society or the culture around us. Jesus hasn't called us out of the world, but he's told us that while we're in the world, we're not to be of the world, in it, but different. And he's called us to be salt and light. And wouldn't it be great if churches and their members were known as sources of blessing and life and goodness among their communities? Seek the welfare, care for the city. And these exiles, even though they would have preferred to be living in Jerusalem and seeking the welfare of Jerusalem, had to settle in Babylon and care about its peace and prosperity. They could do so in the knowledge that God had not forgotten about them and had not written them off because of verse 11. I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. And then thirdly, they were to pray for Babylon. It was a given to pray for Jerusalem. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Peace be within your walls and security within your towers. But Babylon? How do you pray for the prosperity of a place where you didn't want to be and a people who had destroyed your own city? There would be something for the exiles in all of it, because they're told that if Babylon prospers, so would they. Their well-being was tied up with its well-being. Pray for the city, for if it goes well with the city, it will go well with you. And maybe you think in the New Testament of what Paul says to Timothy, that there are to be prayers for people in authority so that they'll govern wisely and Christians can get on with living peaceful lives. Our Christian civic responsibility is to pray for our leaders, to pray for those with power and influence in our country. They need it. Now, we're tempted to laugh at that, aren't we? We all have our opinions about our leaders, and it's very tempting to be cynical, isn't it? It's tempting to join in the chorus of bitter voices in the public conversation. It's also tempting to pray, to play our kingdom of heaven card in a way that attempts to exempt us from any kind of civic responsibility. Our ultimate citizenship isn't here, so we don't need to involve ourselves in the murk of this world. But we're to pray for them. For if they rule wisely and righteously, it will make it easier for us to live lives that honour God. And as we're to love our neighbours, if our country is wisely ruled, it will benefit our neighbours, won't it? Of course, we're to handle it all loosely. You can see what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7. Our ultimate future is not here in this present world. But we're to pray for the welfare of where we are. So you can see how uncomfortable this message must have been for the exiles, at least in the short term. They were to settle in a place that they didn't want to be. They were to stay longer than they wanted to stay. They were to care for people that they might have preferred to hate, and they were to pray for a city that had done them great harm. But God hadn't written them off. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. A hope and a future. Notice as the passage goes on, the promises that God makes from verse 10 to 14. Time will pass. A long time in the context of the average lifespan of an exile, no doubt. But God would eventually bring them back to Jerusalem. They would call, God would listen. Even in Babylon, God's not restricted to hearing prayers prayed in Jerusalem. They would seek him and they would find him and God would bring them back. They're wonderful promises. They get back to Jerusalem, but more than that, their relationship with God is restored. Now, notice two things that we need to take away from all of this. Number one is this: there is no quick fix. There's not always going to be a short-term fix, at least in the way we would like to see it. The Jews would have loved a quick fix, like the message given by the false prophets. But this is not the end of the story. Either for the Jewish exiles or for their captors in Babylon, Babylon would eventually fall. Read chapter 50 of Jeremiah, chapter 51, where you'll read things like this. Babylon will be captured. Bel will be put to shame. Marduk filled with terror. Her images will be put to shame and her idols filled with terror. A nation from the north will attack her and lay waste her land. There may be a window of prosperity, but Babylon will eventually face judgment. It may not be as quickly as the exiles would want, but it will certainly come. God's judgment will come in God's time. And neither is chapter 29 the end of the story for the exiles, because the long-term picture is one of hope and salvation, because God is a God of hope and a God of promise. Now, we love short-term fixes, don't we? We want everything to be put in order right away. If your internet goes down, you need it fixed in 5 minutes. If your car breaks down, you don't want to be without it for a week. We don't want to suffer. You get sick and you hope it's clear by the day after tomorrow, if not sooner. It would be amazing if there was a magic wand that simply repaired broken relationships overnight. We don't like discomfort and uncertainty. I think one of the things we need to underline from this chapter is that even when there is no short-term fix, there is long-term hope. That was the reality for the exiles, and it is our reality too. Our ultimate hope goes beyond this world as we know it, to the coming again of Jesus, who will make everything new, and every tear will be wiped away and all pain will be banished. And the second thing to take away is that this is the kind of God that he is. Tozer said that what comes to our mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And verse 11 needs to be a significant part of that picture, because it describes the kind of God that he is. This is his basic disposition towards his people. Not to harm, but to bring shalom. His disposition is grace and mercy, a hope and a future. You've probably heard of William Cowper. He was a poet and friend of John Newton. He suffered bouts of depression, and like Newton, he also wrote some hymns, including the hymn God Moves in a Mysterious Way. Here are some of the words of that hymn. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Or in Jeremiah's language, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future.